It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Tickets to the Belmont Stakes Racing Festival are on sale now. New York's premier three-day racing festival returns to historic Belmont Park June 6th through 8th. Buy tickets today and enjoy trackside reserve seats or enhance your experience with one of our premium hospitality packages to make this an unforgettable event. Grandstand admission starts at $15 and three-day festival passes are also available. Buy now at Ticketmaster.com or visit BelmontStakes.com. The Belmont Stakes, where champions are crowned.
Amazing achievements for Pennsylvania breeds on the world stage. Thanks to Finest City, Unique Bella, and Shamrock Rose, PA joins Kentucky as the only state in the past decade to breed Eclipse Award champions three straight years. Add that to our unmatched incentives. Plus, our Racehorse Development Fund can only be used to support PA breeding and racing. Why breed anywhere else? This is Brian Sanfratello. Go to PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're back at the races. About 7 minutes in, it looks like, and looking forward to Nick Tamaro talking to Nick about his impressions as well as we, you know, kind of make the rounds and talk to most of the people that we visited with last week. You got the pre and post, so we'll get Nick, and then we'll talk about the Saturday action at Belmont. With the multiple stakes, the Grade One Man of War, obviously Chad Brown going to be a big part of this with focus group, and you do have the invasion by Aiden O'Brien, Magic Wand, and Hunting Horn to add some intrigue, and then in the Bogey, Chad Brown certainly, you know, no surprise there that Chad's, you know, heavily leveraged structural deficit. And where's that import? There's an interesting, it was when I looked at this, when I was looking earlier this morning, there was the other, the imported horse that, caught my eye. Oh, there it is. Homeric in the Bogey. So we'll see what Nick's got to say. Nick Tamaro joins us. Nick, good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. We've got plenty to look forward to at Belmont tomorrow. And there's also the cross-country pick five. We'll talk about that in a minute. But first, I want to get your post-derby thoughts.
Well, I guess it was the most, I don't know exactly what the right word is in terms of describing this derby. It's funny. I mean, when you live in the quote-unquote mainstream world and people bring up horse racing to you, it's unfortunately gotten to a point outside of the Triple Crown where it's almost cringeworthy in terms of what they're going to bring up. And obviously this spring and late winter into spring was a great example of that, with people frequently asking me about Santa Anita and reports they were seeing on horse deaths and whatnot. And now we have this controversial Kentucky Derby, and people are still talking about it, and people are still talking about it, and Gary West, fortunately, is enabling everyone to continue to talk about it. So I think the publicity's great. I mean, I'd be lying if I said it wasn't terrific to hear there still being some conversation about the race itself a week later, and it's not in a particularly negative light. It's in kind of a fun way, and I think it's unfortunate that Mr. West won't put his money where his mouth is and run his horse in the Preakness. And before I get a lot of love notes on Twitter about how he has cuts or something superficial that's wrong with him, this is a horse that certainly would be able to silence a lot of doubt and kind of shove it in everybody's face if he went out and won the Preakness in the Belmont. But that's a different conversation. As far as the race itself, it was a very interesting derby from a lot of standpoints. Obviously, the weather fell apart, and that had a negative impact on the surface. I think that certainly changed things for quite a few horses that may have picked it up a little bit better than others. I've been looking and watching a lot of replays for maybe that Bravazo type of horse that was significantly aided by the wet surface. Doesn't appear as if a whole lot were, other than Country House, who clearly did benefit from a more aggressive ride and picked up that surface quite well. As probably a little bit of a throwback from a racing standpoint, in that Bill Mott was pretty hard on him. You're talking about a horse that ran on February 16th and then again on March 23rd and after that on April 13th. So he was one that, in a day and age where the horses are running less frequently on their way to the Derby, a Country House was more or less made of iron by modern thoroughbred standards. So it was nice to see him step forward. As far as the disqualification goes, and this is a long conversation that I'm happy to engage in with you in multiple weeks. Stewarding in this country is in need of reform. It is not in need of reform because of the Derby. The Derby just might be the thing that signals the change. And what I say about that, it doesn't simply have to do with infractions and disqualifications. It has to do with an obligation that the stewards have to the betting public to ensure that things are done on a thorough and consistent manner. And I think anybody who wanted to tell you that disqualification would have taken place in every jurisdiction in America is probably lying. I couldn't get into the minutiae of figuring out where that would have been a DQ and where it would not have. And so that gets you to the conversation about us potentially adopting something like Category 1 steward standards and Category 1 rules. Now, the thing to me about Category 1 rules that everybody has to understand is that applying Category 1 rules to North American racing is sort of like asking people that are prepared for bariatric surgery to go on 500-calorie diets. I mean, we're not ready for that. Our stewards are not equipped to do that right now. It is going to take a complete reversal of everything that stewarding in this country stands for. And that goes to questioning riders and trainers on tactics. It goes to equipment changes. It goes to more than just simply monitoring post times, posting an occasional inquiry, piggybacking on objections, and making changes based on cost placings. And that's essentially what stewarding in this country is. So I don't want to rant on it, but that is something that I'd love to see. I mean, for example, what am I discussing? Bring in Tom Van Berg to find out why Motion to Motion suddenly didn't show the speed that she normally does while breaking normally in the Oaks. So those are the kind of things that stewards will have to do in a Category 1 jurisdiction to ensure that the betting public is getting a fair shake. Because what happens when you have Category 1 rules is virtually no one's ever disqualified. I mean, it happened. I want to say the statistic on Japanese racing last year was in 3,500 races, it happened 6 times. So, and we're going to be talking about virtually no DQs. What you will have is complete bedlam on the racetrack if you're not enforcing those rules with the jockeys very clearly, and you're not enforcing them with trainers very clearly in terms of how horses are supposed to be ridden, what they're supposed to be wearing, using, working, all of that stuff. So you know, I'm not one of those people, I'll never be one of those people that says we need to adopt what the rest of the world is doing because what we're doing is wrong. But if this signals a change in stewarding and the approach that we take to infractions and disqualifications, then that's fine, because it happened in our biggest race. It happened on a huge stage. I wish that there was a way to carry that momentum forward in terms of general public interest, and I'm hopeful that that still happens. I'm afraid that if we have the owner of that horse doing nothing but releasing statements about how he has legal action that he's going to take, then we'll completely miss that opportunity. I'm still hopeful.
Well, and well said, although the reality of having no DQs is going to be, it will be a shock to the system, too.
Huge, and really, and the problem there, you're exactly right, I would dispute that one bit, and the problem there is that it will be a complete change from the way we have always approached infractions and those kind of things. I mean, the one question that you've asked when you've watched an inquiry or an objection, anything, is did the affected horse get cost the placing? Well, that gets thrown out in Category 1. That does not matter. What matters is would that affected horse have beaten the winner? And, you know, in that scenario, there wouldn't have been a DQ on Saturday. Now, do people think that's right because we're basically saying, sorry, War of Will, you had a quarter of a mile to catch a horse that did come into your path, force your jockey to steady, whether your jockey had made any effort to get position, which was completely legal, by the way. And that's what it would boil down to. And to me, that's, you know, based on the way we've always approached racing, that's not necessarily fair. So now you're talking about having to train the jockey colony to understand that with these different rules, you know, we can't have you out there pinballing. This isn't Mario Kart where you can just take your car and slam it to somebody else and then say, well, hey, he was never getting by me. So, you know, it's a big thing. It's a big change, obviously, that would have to come with a lot of other smaller items associated with it. So what it leaves us with, and I guess really what I didn't answer in terms of your question, is I thought the DQ was justified. I mean, I thought by the way the rules are applied right now, then I thought that it was justified. And watching enough Kentucky racing, understanding how the stewards generally adjudicate the racing in Kentucky, that's a DQ 10 out of 10 times for them. Now, would that have been a DQ in every other jurisdiction in America? I don't know. I'm not confident that it would have. And I think the overarching theme to me is that consistency that I think we could still have, and I think it would make what already is a pretty, you know, pretty solid racing experience for everyone just a little bit better.
Would that have been a DQ in any other derby is the question. I know people are saying, oh, well, saying that it wouldn't be a DQ typically in a derby isn't a good enough answer. But if you've had, you know, decades of precedent, then maybe that is a good answer or a partially, you know, a part of the answer.
Yeah, I agree. And I know there's been obviously a lot of chatter about the various parts of a race and the infractions that may take place. Obviously, the Derby is generally a roughly run race, especially the opening quarter mile. I will say that I think it's very difficult from a steward standpoint to take action on something that happens in the first quarter mile of a 10-furlong race. I mean, it basically has to be a situation where a horse is completely wiped out that ends up coming with another very, very strong run and is beaten by that horse that led the infraction. You know, that's a different scenario. I will also say, and I heard a lot of people talking about this mainly on social media, bringing up the anti-DQ crowd was also very quick to say, well, why wasn't Byron DQ'd in the Breeders' Cup Classic? If you take the approach, especially more of a Category 1 approach, so to speak, 0% chance Byron's DQ'd. Zero. You're never going to have DQs in the opening quarter mile of a race. Doesn't matter if it's a 2-furlong race. You're never going to have a DQ in the early part because the whole rationale is that you have ample time to make up that deficit. And that's really what it all boils down to is do you have enough time? Does your rider persevere and make an effort to get you past that horse? In all likelihood, I've watched tens of thousands of races. I don't really think there's a conceivable scenario where War of Will was beating Maximum Security on Saturday. But I sure as hell think he could have finished better than 7th. You know, and that's what the rule boils down to in this country is was an affected horse interfered with. on top of that, you also had that there wasn't an inquiry posted. There should have been an inquiry posted. I think 10 out of 10 times the stewards would have gone back and they would have posted an inquiry. At the very least, they would have seen the objection, heard the objection, and posted the inquiry also, which is what happens really most often in New York. If the stewards don't post an inquiry, they'll post it after they see the objection. Should they have been more forthright about what exactly the objections were about? Sure. Gaffalione should have been spoken to as well. You know, there were definitely, and I think this is what people are irritated about, and I don't blame them. There should have been more things done for the sake of a complete analysis of the infraction and of the decision that was made to ultimately take the horse down, who, I mean, you don't even really have to be a trip handicapper to know that it was hard to believe that without the infraction on the turn, anybody would have finished ahead of Maximum Security. However, the rules that are in place, the rules that are applied, would lead you to a DQ in that scenario.
There you go. Good job. Otherwise, Nick, hey. Beside that portion that has overshadowed everything, unfortunately, what else struck you? How'd you make out over the weekend?
Well, it was funny. I mean, I was talking to Travis Stone on Sunday morning, and I have to give my man Travis a shout-out. I thought it was quite possibly his best Derby call, and his Derby call keeps getting better year in and year out. I think the conditions were definitely the toughest. And I said, do you remember Newspaper of Record running on Friday? And he was like, yeah, it seems like it was a year ago. So it's kind of funny that we had all of these good horses running over the course of 2 days. And, I mean, all the results were pretty much drowned out by the Derby, which is going to happen even when it's a non-controversial Derby. But we certainly saw some pretty strong performances. I mean, from break-even winning the eight bells and looking like a horse that certainly is deserving of a Grade 1 opportunity. I'm really hopeful they try her in the Acorn. A one-turn mile really feels like it's right up her alley. And then the bounce back from Serengeti Empress was gratifying to see, because Tom Amos did have faith all along that she could do that. And my hat's off to him. You know, I certainly bitch and complain a lot everywhere because I'm a whiner, but about horses not – jockeys not asking for speed, horses being ridden too passively. And Tom Amos had a plan. His filly drew the 13, didn't matter. Everybody inside of him that either got involved in some kind of scrum out of the gate or didn't show the speed that they normally do facilitated Jose Ortiz getting a front-running trip, and she took advantage of it. So I can't really complain about that happening, other than that you wish that other connections with horses that have speed would start to use that. Speed's a real weapon in dirt racing. I don't want everybody to forget that, and I feel like as time goes by, we're getting farther and farther from it. My favorite performance from Saturday was Matoli. And Matoli is a horse that that I was a detractor of. I was not a detractor. I was skeptical of what he was going to do in a strong pace scenario against better horses. And let me tell you, Matoli is as high quality an animal right now, between 6 and 7 furlongs. Another one that I'm hopeful that we see on Belmont Day in the Met Mile. I mean, can you imagine the route ability and the tactical speed of a horse like McKinsey against the just brute force front-running power of a horse like Matoli? I mean, that makes me... I don't care if there are three horses in the Belmont Stakes. That card is worth paying attention to for that race alone. And I think there'll actually be quite a bit more than three horses in the Belmont Stakes. So I was thrilled to see him run well. I thought Brixton Mortar was incredibly impressive. I know it's not one of the strongest older male turf divisions ever, but Brixton Mortar is a horse that at this point has become kind of a lunch pail animal. He shows up every time. He did not get a particularly big setup in the Old Forester Turf Classic and was still able to take advantage of it. When you look at it from a race flow perspective, the two horses that he ran down were essentially on top of the pace the whole way, and he ran over the top of both of them. So that was a particularly strong effort. It was nice to see Mr. Money and Hot Creek Hustle. That's a race where I definitely should have made more money. Betted very, very poorly, given that I used 7, 10, 13 on all of my multis. So, yeah, I was set up well in the pick 5 and pick 4 going into the Derby. Did not have Country House, obviously, so that was frustrating, but ended up with a decent little profit for the weekend. And I think any time you get out of these big days without having your head handed to you, you have to feel a little relieved, I guess, but a little bit spirited by all of it.
That's fair. That's fair. I used that same similar term, too. Just that it was unsatisfying, driving out, and I had the same result too. I ended up for the weekend a skosh, and that was thanks to the Pat Day Mile, pretty much on Saturday, and a good pick 3 in there with the Digital Age. If I knew going in Digital Age was going to be 8-1, my my written analysis would have been different. That was, I thought, the price of the weekend.
Well, and of all, it's funny that you bring that up, and I should have as well. I'm glad you did. Of all the times that we hear about, oh, my God, this horse went in the gate at 9-2, and he crossed the wire at 2-1, and where the hell did the odds go, this and that. I mean, they're running down the backstretch of that race, and I did not look down at my computer to see what the prices were. And I thought, man, Dreda Blue really got pounded. And then they put up Social Paranoia's odds, and I was like, geez, he got pounded too. Well, they come across the wire, and I look at the computer, and I'm like, oh, my God, Digital Age went up to 8-1. I felt like a fool.
And
I felt like a complete imbecile. You know, this was the kind of race where you were saying, oh, yeah, we got a real shot at that, whatever it was, 5-1 or 6-1 morning line, figuring he'd be no better than, I mean, half of that. I thought maybe at most he'd be 4-1 just because of the depth of the field. And then he ends up going off 8-1. Unbelievable. But he's a very nice little horse, sort of Bricks and Mortar Jr. He's one that, and actually, I'll say this, Bricks and Mortar was an impressive 3-year-old early in his season. Digital Age's 3 performances now are more impressive because of the wide trip at Tampa and then the slow pace that he overcame in his second start and the way he was able to run down a high-quality, loose speed horse in a pretty pace-dominated race, the American Turf. So Digital Age is one I think that you'd have to make a... Now, we're not getting 8-1 on him in races like the Pennine Ridge and the Belmont Derby.
Well, and, you know, as much as we always end up talking about the pick fours and the pick fives and, you know, the big numbers that, you know, that can make a mammoth difference when you, frankly, at the end of the year, this sequence is really notable because it starts with Mattoli, who pays $640, and then Digital Age paid $1920. And Mr. Money paid $17. The 50-cent pick three paid $249 for 50 cents. And that, to me, I mean, this was my everything that I ended up with on the weekend came down to these three races. And I did not have Mattoli in my picks because we, you know, as we were. You know, as we had discussed, we were looking for a bit of a meltdown, and we wanted somebody from behind the leaders. I didn't have Digital Age in the picks because I thought, well, let's reach for some prices. And, you know, I was interested in Social Paranoia, whose price, you know, ended up coming way down. I played with Casa Creed and Black Album. You know, I wanted to get as many viable numbers in as possible. But I did like Mr. Money and Hot Creek Hustle. Well, I put together the pick three ticket, Nick, and wasn't a big ticket, and $249 for every 50 cents was unbelievable, not to mention what you got, you know, the $200 exacta on Mr. Money and Hog Creek Hustle, as well as close to a $700 try with Dreammaker third. I mean, it took exactly, you know, 90 minutes, basically, to make the weekend. And if you can identify a sequence where you've got a, you know, an opinion you want to leverage, that's your weekend, whether you cash the Derby or not.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, I hit the try in the Pat Day Mile and kind of felt like a fool when I saw the exacta payoff. You know, the exacta was really, I thought, the biggest value because, I mean, Dreammaker at 16-1 made for, it was a nice try payoff, but it certainly could have been, bigger. And you don't want to miss opportunities on these races. They're, you know, they're not going to give you a ton of them where it seems like you can really wrap your head around it. So you want to make them pay when you can. And, that's a great example. I did not handled some of the multi-race plays as well as I could have. I was a little too focused on pick fours and pick fives, and you're absolutely right. I mean, there were, how did the Digital Age, as you were just saying, I think the Digital Age Mr. Money Double paid $163. So, I mean, you're looking at it's a right around the parlay, but still, I mean, I didn't feel like those horses were respectively 8-1 and 7-1 shots in their races. So if you believe that they were a lot likelier than that, then that's a double, I think, that you could have really zoomed in on that combination and played it multiple times and given yourself a real opportunity to make a score. You know, my weekend more or less was made. It was set up perfectly on Friday when I keyed Solid Wager in the try and caught the try underneath Cummings for just for 50 cents, and it paid a fortune. You know, I made a very small play. I was playing some multi-race bets and figured out, hell with it, I'll throw in the try. And you know, here came 22-1, 7-2, and 46-1. So just the big fields and the amount of value that's there is what really draws us to these big cards and gives us an opportunity to make real money. So it certainly didn't disappoint in that respect. I think the wagering was kind of fun in that it was a little crazy long shot wise early, and then there were some logical favorites in the latter half of the card that certainly gave way to the less than logical results in the Kentucky Derby. But it'll be good to get everything settled now, and we have this weekend bridging the gap before Preakness, which, regardless of who shows up and how big the field is, the card will still be a lot of fun.
Well, and as I said to Marty, we've reviewed some of the horses that finished second and third with logicals that really kind of boosted opportunities as well. You didn't have to pick all winners. You could have keyed off of any number of horses. Hog Creek Hustle was a horse that, we pounded the drum on to get people to tinker with, and certainly Mr. Money was a horse you wanted to use, and so you had your opportunity. I referenced Got Stormy, and there was also the nice performance that Tommy Bush's horse, Clyde's
Image. Twice in a row, Clyde's Image has run great. I mean, he's a very, very nice horse. And I think there's a nice little grade at stake out there with Clyde's Image's name on it.
Yeah, and Kurban kind of interloped for me in that spot. I singled Bricks and Mortar on all the tickets, but I really keyed off of Clyde's Image trying to get something hooked up with Bricks and Mortar in terms of the tries. And again, it's a reminder. We talk about this at Breeders' Cup time a lot, and we forget that big days like this also are just as germane. If you're a pick four, pick five player, and given the size of fields and the depth of the fields, you can back yourself up to pick threes. As evidenced by the 50-cent version we just talked about, if you're a pick three player, play doubles and lower the risk factor, and you can still use the same multiples or the same dollar increments that you were going to spend on the bigger multis, but leverage them harder into things like doubles. And same thing with the supers. If you're a super player and these fields are too big and unwieldy, cut back to tries. If you're a try player, cut back to exactas. I mean, there's ways to make it easier on yourself because this is not an ordinary Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or even an ordinary Saturday.
That's a fact. Yeah, you have to diversify what you're doing. And again, I mean, we have this happen. As you said, we have it happen at Breeders' Cup. I think to a great extent you have it happen at a place like Saratoga. If you're a Gulfstream player in the winter, you'll notice that, you're just not capitalized enough to play pick fives. And so you need to start looking at pick fours and so on and so forth. And with the super being at a $1 price point during Oaks and Derby, it's going to take a lot of the normal superfecta play nowadays out of the equation. It's really just designed for the people with bigger bankrolls. I mean, I didn't play one super. I usually try and play one in a race that I feel like I can narrow down. But, I mean, there were times last weekend where it felt like I couldn't narrow down a four-horse race. Right. So some of these fields were just maddening, and trying to go through them and pick out who you were going to exclude seemed like an exercise of futility. So it is. It's important to manage your bankroll, because otherwise your bankroll will manage you, and you'll end up in a tough spot because these races can easily become money pits.
Well, Nick, let's hit a couple of highlights on tomorrow's Belmont card. And the 8th, 9th, and 10th are probably the most important races for players, in addition to being the center of the Naira Betts Pick 5. The 8th, 9th, and 10th are also the 3rd, 4th, and 5th legs of the Cross Country Pick 5, which, as I told people earlier, includes the stake at Monmouth, the Serena's Song, the 10th, and the opening leg, which is the 8th at Woodbine, the Ballad. So let's hit some of the Belmont highlights from what you see tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, before we talk about the cross-country pick five race, it's obviously nice to see Separation of Powers back in the opener. I'm a little surprised to see a graded stake as the first.
I know, I said that. I said same thing.
Well, Martin Pants are getting a little tricky on us throwing one in there. It does spice up the early pick five, I guess. So early pick five with a couple of graded stakes in it. So Separation of Powers was stretched out for the Cotillion. Obviously, it's not a two-turn horse, which we've now seen in a couple of tries. But probably ran a race that day, speed figure wise, that would put her squarely in the mix in here. She's a horse to beat, even off the layoff. I know we've seen some Chad Brown horses come back off the bench and maybe not perform quite at the level we expected, but she's better than this field and figures to get a nice little setup with Heaven Has My Nikki towards the inside. With Kendra Carmouche on board, I would imagine that's going to be an all-out send. And I think when push comes to shove, Separation of Powers is a horse that wants to sit a little bit off the pace, and she'll be able to do that. So I'm looking forward to seeing her back and would imagine there are some bigger objectives for her down the line. The Peter Pan is a small field, and it's disappointing to see only five go for $300,000. It looks like Todd Fletcher kind of has a lock on it with Intrepid Heart. However, I'm a little bit more intrigued from a, and really this is from a multi-race betting perspective, in using at least two, because I like Global Campaign. And I think Global Campaign, the one turn mile in an eighth is going to help quite a bit. I know he's been off since the Fountain of Youth. They tried to get him into the Pat Day Mile. He was excluded. I think when you go back and watch that Fountain of Youth, it was a much better performance than we all originally thought. And everybody coming out of that race obviously was so taken by the poor performance of Hidden Scroll that they sort of ignored that the Global Campaign did run very well, tracking that super hot pace, making a middle move into it. While the ultimate objectives for him that might be a little bit more of a fit could be shorter around one turn, I think the one turn figures to be a big help to him. And I also wonder exactly what's going to happen pace-wise. I mean, if Luis Saez shows some level of commitment to the lead, I really don't think Federal Case is going to be sacrificed in order to keep Global Campaign honest, and he might find himself on a pretty lonely lead. Mile and an eighth at Belmont around one turn, big misnomer about that being a bad trip for speed. That's actually a great trip for front-running horses. And if you can get out and rock everybody to sleep on that long run to the far turn, you can definitely build yourself a pretty big advantage. Just touching on the stakes along the way, the Bogey is a race that is completely devoid of early pace. However, I will say, in going back and watching some of Coleman Reek's races last year, she does have some early foot. So I would imagine she'll be positioned probably close to Andina Del Sur, who I'm guessing will be put on the lead by Luis Saez. She did show some speed last year in the Pebbles. That was a bit of a quirky turf course. It was very, very boggy after a lot of rain, but it does look like she's the most likely to be forwardly placed. Homer Reek was a length off of Wild Illusion and Magic Wand, and we don't have to think back that far to remember, obviously, Magic Wand's running on this card, but Wild Illusion was one of the main contenders in the Breeders' Cup Filly and Mare Turf and nearly took down Sister Charlie, who got her in the final stride. So clearly, Homer Reek has run against some really, really good horses overseas. And it's a good thing to see Chad Brown with a high-quality female turf horse. I mean, it's been so long since we've seen him with any of these types that it's great to see that not only does he have one, but he has two, a grade one winner domestically. Obviously coming. Sorry, as I was being a wise ass, my headphones fell out of my phone. So we have Chad Brown pretty well set up in this Bogey. It does look like one of his two will get it. So the eighth is the first Belmont leg of the cross country pick five, and this looks like a fun race. You have Varenka coming back off a layoff for Graham Motion. She was a long shot, obviously, in the Juvenile Phillies turf, but hardly disgraced herself. Found herself a little bit farther off the pace than she needed to be. Now she's off the layoff. Structural deficit for Chad Brown has a modicum of turf pedigree, and we've seen him win with a lot of pedigree-less horses along the way. I couldn't help but be drawn to Inspector Havers, who is by Tisnow not the greatest turf stallion, but is out of search of Criminologist, who obviously was a daughter of Search Party, which makes this horse a sibling of Inspector Lindley, who's one of our favorites, of course. It feels like every time we've talked about Inspector Lindley on your show, he's run well. So you also have the very nicely bred Romantic Pursuit, who's out of Questing, multiple grade one winner herself, and that was improved quite a bit getting to the turf. So it feels like one of those principals will probably be among the main players. And then in the run happy, Stan Huff sent in Recruiting Ready along with Global Campaign for this card, and Recruiting Ready was drawn poorly in the Commonwealth in a race that was just loaded with speed. He didn't get out of the gate that cleanly, didn't get the position that he wanted, and kind of just spun his wheels around there while really not disgracing himself at all, and now comes back in a race where he's drawn perfectly. He should be in stock and pounce territory the whole way, and really, other than Skyler Scramjet, there's no zip in this race, and he figures to be in a really ideal position. It'll be interesting to see if Frenzy Fire bounces back. Obviously, Frenzy Fire's best race by a mile came on this strip, and his two biggest efforts in terms of wins have both come at Belmont, winning the Champagne as a two-year-old and then the Dwyer last year in what was just a really eye-catching effort. So if you're playing in the multis, obviously you're going to use all three. There's no point in being beaten by Skyler Scramjet, but I'm going to be the type of person that comes back and singles Global Campaign on something that might enable me to go a little bit deeper in the more competitive legs of the bet all in all. The Man of War, as you alluded to earlier, Aiden O'Brien sent a couple in. Hunting Horn feels like a horse that they probably sent to keep Magic Wand Company on a plane. He's a horse that has come over to America a couple times, but he's just lesser than a grade one type. Magic Wand is the horse I think that this barn is serious about in terms of winning, and she was installed at 3-1, which figures to be about her price. Focus Group overcame a slow pace in the Pan American, had a really good trip rallying up the inside, but again, the setup was not there at all, and he performed very well. It's a little difficult to envision Focus Group as a true grade one horse, but I think that this is kind of his scenario. He's going to get some pace to run at. Village King is in there. Epical is in there. And here's a horse that really, if he gets any kind of running in front of him, he's going to get what he needs. And Irad's probably going to be able to save some ground. This is a horse that likes cover. And when he pops out and can produce that one run, he certainly becomes quite a bit tougher. Did you like anybody in the Man of War that I didn't talk about?
Well, I'm watching. I'm very interested in Epical because I was with Cassidy on Saturday at Churchill, and I asked him about Epical, who he really, really likes, and who you know he feels is going to be a good horse for a long time. And he does not have to have the lead either. I mean, he's a horse that can rate. But I mean, if you're going to talk about the potential for this thing to have some legitimate pace, how does it not help Zulu Alpha?
It certainly should, and I think as far as Zulu Alpha goes, a mile and three-eighths is a little bit better for him than a mile and a half. And that being said, I did think Jose Ortiz asked him to do a little bit too much hard running in the Elkhorn. He made an early move. He was wide. He and Red Knight probably should have been the exacta in that race, but they were so, I think that their two riders respectively were so concerned about each other that and I think Jose Ortiz on Zulu Alpha was worried about staying inside, maybe getting in traffic, anything like that. That they just moved too soon, and that enabled Bigger Picture to run them down late. So, yeah, I think the two turns in the mile and three-eighths will really be in Zulu Alpha's wheelhouse, and I'm expecting Castellano to be able to get him to another kind of inside stalking type of position. The good thing about Zulu Alpha in these races, and obviously Mike Maker is so good in turf marathons, the good thing about him is that he's really not slow. So it's not as if he's some kind of pace horse, but he's not going to allow himself to be shuffled out and lose too much ground early. So that's a big credit. And look, you're going to get probably four times the price on him that you did last time. And it's not like the field that he's facing is that much tougher.
You know who's going to get lost on this board is Arklow.
He is. And you know, he really doesn't deserve to be lost on the board. He was second to Zulu Alpha when Florent Giroux probably moved a little soon in the Sycamore. Another horse that obviously the mile and three-eighths will be a good fit for. He was a little... You know, you look at his most recent efforts and what was a poor performance. I guess the Stars and Stripes was a poor performance. The inside pass on that Arlington Surf Course that day were absolutely the place to be. And he was parked in the middle of the track for the latter four furlongs of the race. So he really has fired just about every single time. And again, while maybe not having proven that he's truly grade one caliber, this is not a, it's just, and I don't mean to demean it over and over, this is just not really a particularly strong grade one. And these horses are mainly, you know, grade 1.5 to 2 types. So, yeah, I think he's one that this feels like a race in the multi-race sequence where you want to have your A's, you want to have some B's and C's because I think that contention does run pretty deep and we could see a variety of different winners potentially.
Got to get Scully in here, but did we look at the Ballad and the Serena Song?
Yeah, the Serena Song looks like Forever Liesel's race to lose, yeah. Coming off the top right where she was close to that fast, made a big move into that fast pace. I expect her to be pretty tough at 3-5 or so. I'm guessing Breaking Bread is probably her biggest threat, given that she has some speed, and it is Jorge Navarro at Monmouth. And then the Ballad at Woodbine, you have a couple of horses getting back to Canadian connections after trying races in the United States, and that includes the Rail, La Silent Sonnet, who should be a pretty strong favorite now. We're back with Nick Gonzalez after doing some good things last year. I would imagine she'll be relatively tough to beat. And Scotty's Model is back in the care of Norm McKnight, who she did well for throughout last year, including a win in this race almost a year ago. So it feels like that's going to be relatively chalky. I would probably find a way to throw in Zestina and Summer Sunday, who's got a little recency now, second off the layoff, does have some speed. So a race where I think you could use a few. So, yeah, it looks like a challenging, interesting cross-country pick five on our tweener weekend between the Derby and Preakness.
Well, those that are playing this, make sure you use Red Cabernet in black, seasonal debut for the five-year-old, and I am absolutely getting her on the ticket. She's going 8-1 morning line, and she's clever in there.
Almost as clever as you, Steve.
Ba-dum-bum. Nick, I appreciate it, and we'll catch up from Baltimore next week.
Sounds good. Can't wait.
Nick Tamaro, everybody. We'll put a Game Builder ticket together. Both of us will, do a combined effort, you and I. All right?
Sounds great. Have a good weekend. Thanks for having me.
NTAM1215 on your Twitter. We'll stay right here. We got 15 minutes to spend with Scully, and he's standing by. He's been listening in, and maybe he's got some counterpoints. Maybe he's got some overlap, but before anything else, James, good morning. And I was with you most of Friday and Saturday in the parlay. You had a good weekend.
Yeah, it turned out pretty good for me on Friday, Steve. Thanks. Glad to be on with you. Yeah, Digital Age and Mr. Money, I bet both those horses. And, I liked that good storm in the Distaff Turf Mile, and a good friend of mine, pretty sharp guy, he was on the Beau Recall. So I boxed that exact, and then I just was off
nice.
And after that. So
nice, very nice.
Kurban. I bet him to win in place and had a little bit of saver on him, but that would have just broke. That would have made for a huge day if he had won. I really liked his chances, and at 13-1, I thought he ran a great race for second.
Well, and then let's get your Derby thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one. I mean, basically, we sort of talked about it, beforehand. I mean, in the Derby, every year it seems it's a type of race where two or three of the horses that are in the top four turning for home, wind up in the top four at the wire. And, there were four horses that were pretty much, they are in that position in the charts. And it was Maximum Security, Country House, Code of Honor, and War of Will. And unfortunately, Maximum Security drifted out into the path of War of Will. And the stewards deemed it to be a foul, and, they took him down. I mean, it's not the first time in a big Grade 1 race where the leader has unnecessarily, in my opinion, done something like that, where it made absolutely no difference in the outcome. In the 78 Travers, affirmed it was the best horse. He had won 10 in a row going into that race. He got the easiest perfect trip, and for no reason he came over and fouled another horse who then fouled for Aladar, and he wins by two lengths in third gear, and there's no way if Aladar was going to beat him, and they took him down. And it was the same thing in the 04 Arlington Million when Powers Court ran by kicking Chris like he was tied to a pole. All he had to do was avoid making contact with the pole. Instead, he veered in a little bit, forced that horse into the rail. He wins by open lengths, and they take him down. And, it's just unfortunate the way it happened. I thought it was warning because, to me, War of Will could have hit the board easily if he doesn't get interfered with. And I've talked to people who bet War of Will, and they just are like, hey, they thought he was going to win turn for home. And it just it didn't give him a fair chance. He was knocked off stride, briefly stumbled, lost his momentum, and that was the end of the race for him. And just to go back to that point, I mean, Code of Honor on the official chart is first at the mile mark. He is first. He gets beat nearly three lengths. He had nothing left for that stretch run. He just held his positioning, and positioning is everything in the Kentucky Derby. And if a horse gets wiped out at the top, turning for home like that, I mean, it eliminates their fair chance. And, so it's unfortunate because he didn't have to do it, but, that was the way I saw it.
Yeah, I appreciate it. We've surveyed, all of our regulars, and it's fascinating what a diverse view that people have of it. I suppose the last thing like this was the Breeders' Cup, which we keep, you know, people keep referencing, yeah. but that's a different part of the, you know, different part of the race, and you know, the we've got.
Well, they should have taken Bayern down. I mean, that's where the consistency part of it drives people crazy. Well, yeah. That was a clear foul, and they left him up, and that's all, you know, people are asking for a lot of times is just consistency, Steve.
Well, and the beginning of a race has, you know, historically been a place where you can get away with murder. And, you know, until there's a wholesale, and we just discussed that with Nick Tamaro, actually, Nick with a terrific presentation on the topic, until there's a wholesale change on that front, you know, we're going to assume that people will continue to get away with murder at the beginning of races and in first turns and so forth. Well, let's turn our attention to the weekend and go where you might. James, what do we got for us?
Well, I'll just go over on the Belmont. I mean, I looked at those Belmont Stakes. I mean, some short fields are opening it up, but I mean, I'll just go through the graded action. Race one is that Vagrancy. Separation of Powers coming back off a long way off in there. It's a big favorite, but I like Pacific Gale. I think she's got a big chance to run a big race on the front end in this spot. Ran into a really nice one last time and wound up, being 6 lengths clear of second. So I'm going to give her the edge in the Vagrancy. Turning the attention to the Peter Pan. I mean, obviously, Intrepid Heart to me looks like a horse that could win the Belmont Stakes. I think he's got, big time potential through and through, and really like that effort, to wear down the high crime in that allowance and win at Keeneland on that opening weekend, when it was inside was the place to be. But I will say this about that race. He doesn't have to win the Peter Pan to win the Belmont. And it's intriguing to me, this Global Campaign, should get just the perfect trip on the front end. I loved his debut win. His allowance race was just okay. And, you know, he didn't fire his best effort in that Fountain of Youth, I didn't think. But he's been freshened. I think, he's like, from the same family as Boldoro. And I think he still has an upside for Stanley Huff. So I think Global Campaign's eligible to get a perfect, like, just easy peasy front-running trip in there. And he's got a shot to upset Intrepid Heart, I thought, in the Peter Pan.
Well, and Nick Tamaro echoed that same sentiment, and I would not be, I would not overlook Final Jeopardy in here either.
Yeah, another one that just things didn't go right for him in that Wood Memorial.
Yeah, he got wiped out. It was over in two seconds. The race was over.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's the kind of race, too, where I think that race, after he gets wiped out, he still made a decent mental move in that race that was easy to appreciate. So, Final Jeopardy, I bet him in the Woods. So that tells you what I thought of that field going into it. But, it's for a short field. It's interesting. Intrepid Heart, he's going to be odds on in there. No doubt about that, I think. So, turning the attention to the race number seven, the Bogey, competition of ideas is a huge presence in this race. I looked at it and I just think that Andina Del Sur has a real fitness advantage over her. I like the way she's coming in this race for Albatroni, and think she's got a chance to get the run on Competition of Ideas, who is such a confirmed closer or has been in her recent stakes efforts. So I'm going to give Andina Del Sur the slight edge in that Bogey.
Nice. I like her as a horse. This it's an interesting race with the pair of Chads and Clement too. Down inside, but I happen to be a Dina Del Sur fan myself. How about the last two stakes?
The Man of War. That's another race where you've got Chad. I look at this focus group. And I really like how he took his time last year with him as a four-year-old. He looks poised to have a big five-year-old season. But, you know, he's a 100% like, you know, dead closer, late runner. And I'm intrigued by Channelmaker coming back to Belmont Park for Belmont. I thought that was a pretty solid effort last time where he was like a little bit rank in the early going from an outside post and held in there pretty well when he could have just, you know, spit the bit and been up the track. And I just think he's going to sit a perfect trip off at Epicall, who looks like he's going to go forward at the start and be showing the pace under Tyler Bays. And I think Channelmaker, you know, at 6-1 on the morning line, really, you know, has a chance to run well in there at decent odds. And that's what I like in the Man of War Channelmaker.
Very good. Well, I know you're getting ready for broadcast, but there's still time for the last-minute Friday push.
I tell you, it was a little bit of a bummer because I had a scratch on one that I was really looking forward to tabbing on there for you guys. But in race number nine, that race has a couple of big favorites in there, and Voight and a couple others. And number nine, Just Might, is going to run big off the freshening in this spot for Michelle Lovell. It's going to be a little bit overlooked due to false class concerns. 6-1 on the morning line with Jack Gilligan. My last minute push is number nine, Just Might, in the ninth race at Churchill Downs today.
Well, there you go. So the nine in here, Just Might for the Cougar. Michelle Lovell, 6-1 with her go-to jock, Jack Gilligan. I love it. James, thanks for everything last couple of weeks while we were in town. It was a wonderful, as always, a wonderful Derby experience, even with the rain and even with the final confusion.
What do you think about Always Mining? Boy, he looks tough as nails to me in the Preakness.
I agree.
Taking an early look at the field.
I picked him in my wagering guide preview that releases later today. However, the presence now of Warriors Charge does kind of change the dynamics a little bit, because Always Mining will now not necessarily be controlling speed, not with Warriors Charge in there.
Right. Well, look forward to talking about the Preakness next week, Steve, and thanks for having me, and good luck to you this weekend.
James, I appreciate it, everybody. James Scully _111, and Scully, always a pleasure, and does such a great job, got such a good opinion. We will take a top of the hour break, and when we come back, we've got Paul Matisse, we've got Hammer, DeRosa, and Nick Cassato, so it's going to be a busy final 60 minutes as we close out post-Derby Oaks review period. It always takes a full 5 days around here, but it was a particularly acute recapping sequence this year. One more hour to go before we send you into the weekend. Stay with us.